When I was a kid, I was a big-time reader. I still am, but as a child, reading was a huge issue in my life. And a year or two ago, I was in a bookstore, used bookstore, and I came across a book that I had gotten as a kid in my very first book club. Somewhere along the line, my parents were really wise and enrolled me in a book club, and the highlight of my life was when that little box showed up at the house every, 3 weeks or so with a new book. Anyway, I found one of those books from that book club, and I have it in my library. It's called Follow the Leader. It's about a boy who's blind, and he has a guide dog. Well, anyway, that's beside the point. The point is that reading was a huge issue as a kid, and for many of you, I'll bet it was as well. And I will bet that many of you read Laura Ingalls Wilder's book series. There were 9 manuscripts in all. Books like Little House in the Big Wood, On the Banks of Plum Creek. Is this ringing some bells? Yes. By the Shores of Silver Lake. And then Little House on the Prairie. She wrote those 9 manuscripts at a time in her life when she was moving and doing some things as well. But in particular, Laura, we get to follow her as she goes through really a bunch of states. She starts in Missouri, goes to Kansas and Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and South Dakota. And the discussion of those books is around her and her family. Just a little reminder, we got Ma and we got Pa. Remember them? Yes, you're with me now, I can tell. You got Ma and Pa. You got, 5 children, 1 adopted son, and then they picked up another little boy along the way somewhere. Who was the main character? What was her name? Laura, yes. All of this was made into a TV series. You might remember the TV series better than the books. From 1975 until 1982, we got to regale through the stories on the little screen in our home of Laura and her family. Little House on the Prairie became kind of a watchword for the kind of life that was lived that had certain characteristics. And I put on your notes some of those characteristics. First was that a character was a really big deal. The personal values of integrity and honor were far more important than job or money or even position. Oftentimes, Paul would take a job that had nothing to do with money or position, but he needed to do something for his family, or he would serve someone else. Character permeated that book series and certainly the TV series. At the center of everything was the family. You know, Mom and Pa and the kids around the dining room table was the primary focus of that series. Absolutely everything was measured against the family. That family core was run by a set of authoritative parents. In all cases, Mom and Dad gently but firmly guided their children with biblical principles. The Bible actually was physically out in many of the TV series, and certainly in the book, there's reference to guiding the family according to biblical principles. Kids were cherished, but not idolized. And you should have gone, ouch, at that point, because that is not true today. Very often, the idol in our homes today is our children. We have them in an inappropriate and uncomfortable spot where they're more than just cherished. They get to the point of being maybe idolized. From a practical standpoint, the whole family centered around an hour in the evening that was dinner time. And around that table, the focus of their family was evident. It was a family event, and it focused on much more than the food that was before them. That was the time when they sorted out the day's events and gave context to certain principles that were going to be true in their family and in their life. Time was the commodity that was exchanged, not money. Everything was based on whether it involved time, and time was generously, in both the book series and in the TV series, shared. And last but not least, the truth of the matter is, on almost every episode, certainly the TV series, you know, it all ended up with perfect balance. Yeah, that's not real life, is it? But nonetheless, it's an important part of whatever. The point that I was making in my thoughts about all this introduction of Little House on the Prairie is that you and I don't live there. I don't know that we ever did. but we certainly don't in 21st century Southern California living. I was up in Northern California this past weekend, north of Sacramento, north of Grass Valley, up in the Nevada City area. And I have to tell you, they view us down here as an interesting cultural phenomena that they want nothing to do with. They might perceive themselves as Little House on the Prairie, and we're the other. And the other is a Little House on the Freeway. I have some thoughts today that I want to focus yours and mine, the lesson is primarily for me, on this whole issue of finding a resting place amid a restless pace. We don't live on Little House on the Prairie anymore. Our homes, our lives, our attention to activities are much more like Little House on the Freeway. Imagine, if you will, in the middle of a clover leaf, a house. And amid all of that noise and frustration, the pace, the potential danger, the hassle, that's where most of us really are living in our culture. What are some characteristics of our living? I mentioned those that were characterized by Little House on the Prairie. What might ours be like? Well, first off, we're not communicating much. Most recent study that I found says that if there is an excellent, wonderful, loving relationship that's fully functioning between husband and wife, you may spend up to 4 minutes a day actually communicating. Think about that for a second. 4 minutes a day between the two people that are the most important relationship that God has for us in the context of the most important relationship that God has for us in the family. And why do we not communicate? Because we're too busy. And what are we too busy at? We are too busy at earning a living, making certain that a certain standard of living is imposed, and 1,000 other activities, some of which are good, some of which are not. It's not my job today to try to tell you what you could or could not or should not do, but to say that 4 minutes a day are spent in the communication of the most important relationship God has for us ain't good. Unless we think that's the only place where we're lacking in some communication, same study cites somewhere between 37 seconds and 5 minutes a day parents are spending communicating with their children. 37 seconds. I hold my breath for longer than that when I have hiccups. 37 seconds to maybe a maximum of 5 minutes a day looking at your kid, communicating with your child about their life, their issues, their character, their goals, their spiritual upbringing. 5 minutes a day? That's awful. That's awful. On Sunday night, I flew home from Northern California. I had spoken 4 one-hour sessions over the weekend. I was absolutely spent. I could barely say my name. I was exhausted. But I knew Brianna was going back to college, and I didn't get a chance to see her all weekend, and so I wanted some time. So I called Barb and said, you know, let's have Brianna meet us at Outback. Let's have dinner together. We won't have to cook anything. We can sit down. We can have some iced tea, and I can talk and absorb and all that stuff that I didn't get to hear all weekend long. Well, we sat down to eat, and it wasn't the greatest meal because I kept thinking Brianna was being a twit. She wasn't communicating very well. She was full of herself. She was rattling on about nonsensical stuff. She was talking 500 words a minute. It was really not very good. We went to get in the car. Brianna was with her boyfriend. They drove one way. Barb and I got in the car, and I commented to her, you know what? What's with Brianna? Well, what I didn't know is when I went home, collapsed in bed, and was sound asleep by 8:30, Brianna came in and said to Barb, what was with Sherry? You know, she kept interrupting me. She wasn't looking at me. She wasn't talking to me. What was her problem? So we had lunch the next day, and Barb goes, I just want you two to take a moment. Brianna, why don't you share with Sherry what your thoughts were? And Brianna goes, well, what was your problem last night? And she said, you interrupted and you didn't look at me. I did. I didn't know I did that. She said, I thought you were asleep, but your eyes were open. I had to apologize to her because here, this wonderful moment that I wanted to have communicating, I obviously blew it. So I'm not on your case. I'm just saying this is a characteristic of our homes and why I'm suggesting today that we live on a little house on the end of the freeway, not on the end of the prairie. We have a lot of desires for fantasies Because a lot of our families are looking at their own real lives and going, ooh, this isn't so much fun. So we are escaping into fantasy land, evidenced by how much reality TV we watch and laugh at someone else's reality, somehow making a fantasy of the whole thing for ourselves. We're doing a lot of anchoring. That's a technical term, but what it really means is our society is reaching back and talking a lot about spiritual roots. Now, we're not talking about God and His claim on our lives. We're talking about spiritual things. A lot of emphasis on things like candles and incense and getting in touch with spiritual roots that were part of our parents' culture or grandparents or something else. Not trying to get in touch with Almighty God who might have a claim on our life, but just kind of that, let's be spiritual. A lot of influence from the East, if you will. We're doing a lot of cocooning, too. We are overprotecting ourselves and our children from what we perceive to be the harsh realities of the outside world. We really are, as a culture, pulling back, sometimes to the detriment of our children. I think it is 9 families that will not allow their children to go on a spring trip this year. And the reason is their kid has never been away from home, and they do not want to have any environment where they're trusting anyone else other than themselves to be with their children. Now, I tell you candidly, I don't think that's the healthiest perspective. I'm not on those parents' cases. They have a responsibility to make those decisions. But in general, as a culture, this protect stuff is not all that healthy. Another thing is we have very indulgent lifestyles. We are absolutely stressed out consumers. Our homes, our lifestyles are often focused on things. That is not good old Ma and Pa's perspective. The things they had was a table, a rough table, some benches that they sat on. The kids slept in a loft, if you'll remember. They had one bed underneath. It was a one-room house with a little nook in the back, which I assume is where the stove was that she cooked. You and I are very indulgent. We are not living simple lives. And the lack of simplicity adds a layer of frustration to our lives. We are leading what I called in your notes the 99 lives, way too fast of a pace. And in a moment, I'm going to give you a quiz so you can convince yourself where your life pace is as well. In fact, if you'll turn to the back of your notes, I asked Monet to add a survey. I called it a self-evaluation. Do you find it? It will allow you to rate yourself and your family in a number of areas. Take out a pen, make a circle, nobody has to see it, we won't look, we're not going to turn these in. But let's see how you do for each one of these categories. Let me walk you through them. First off, you give yourself a 1 if it's really not a problem at all for yourself or your family. 2 if you're overloaded occasionally in that area. 3 if you're impacted pretty consistently. 4 if you know you're pretty much overloaded in that area. And 5 if you're absolutely buried. All right? You with me? Are you all asleep out there today? Or am I just stomping on your toes? It's the daylight savings. Okay. First one, activity overload. Booked up weeks in advance, squeezing in things, trying to do 2 or 3 things at the same time. Activity overload taking away your pleasure of looking forward to something or even your pleasure of reminiscing afterwards. Most recent survey here at Stony Brook indicates that the majority of the kids are involved in 4, count them, 4 days worth of outside activities in a given school week. That is not good. Give yourself a score. 1, it's not a problem for you. You're just absolutely balanced. 2, occasionally. 3, pretty impacted. 4, absolutely overloaded. And 5, forget it, we're buried. Second one, change overload. You and I are living in a time when change is exponential. Up through about 1950, change was at a very regulated pace. I'm talking about cultural changes, big changes in all of our lives. They happened at a pretty consistent pace, every 30 years, significant change. We hit the 50s and it went bananas. We are in exponential change, overload. It makes a difference in our lives. The things you have to learn and relearn. Let's think just for a moment about a telephone. I'll look around the room and see if I see anybody old enough for this to be true. Nope, not. I'm probably one of the oldest in the room anyway. The earliest phone you ever remember using, was it two pieces? You do remember two pieces? Talking into one, holding it in the other piece? Well, I'm not to the dial one yet. I'm back to the, you know, it was two pieces. You picked up the ear thing and you talked into the other part. Anybody remember that? No. Then the next one after that is the one you did like this one. It was heavy. It was black. You couldn't prop it underneath your shoulder. It was too heavy. It almost took two hands to hold it. And you had to wait for it to as it turned back. Okay? Then we went to push buttons. And now we've got what? Screens. You know, I recently got a smartphone, and it's like, man, this is cool. All you do is, you know, type in two numbers, and it starts trying to anticipate what it is you're dialing. And if you get to the third number, it's going to give you four alternatives. Are you trying to call her or him or him? You know, we don't even have to dial anymore, just kind of a number or two, and the computer makes a guess as to who you're trying to call. It is part of change overload. How are you doing with that? Let's talk about choice overload. Are you impacted by the choices that you make every day? In 1978, it was estimated that there was a little under 12,000 items in the normal run-of-the-mill supermarket. I am told that today that number is something like about 25,000 items you get to choose from when you go run into the market to buy some bread. That is a gigantic change. And there's a little note in your notes, I think, about how much cereal there is now. Maybe 186 different choices of cereal. When you grew up, what was there? Cheerios and Corn Flakes. I remember those two. And a little shredded wheat. Nobody ate shredded wheat. I was a Cheerios girl. My brother was a Corn Flakes. Raisin Bran came a little later. Sorry, it wasn't during my earliest time. 186 choices of cereal. You say, well, what's the big deal? It just adds another layer of demand on you. You're going to pick up cereal. Well, which one? Eggs. I went to buy eggs not too long ago. It took me 10 minutes to decide. Did I want the really big ones or the not so big ones or the little ones? Did I want the brown ones or the white ones? Did I want them in a pack of 6 or a pack of 12 or a pack of 18 or a pack of 24? Those are decisions you have to make to get eggs. That wears on us. So give yourself a score. Debt overload. Every sector, every part of our society is absolutely awash in red ink today. The average Californian, Southern Californian family has in excess of $30,000 in credit card debt, and saying nothing of your mortgage, nothing of a car payment, nothing of a college payment, guess where I'm living, sheer credit card debt. Now you say, well, why does that have anything to do with living on the end of the freeway? Because when that much debt is on you, there is a pressure. There's a pressure to perform, a pressure to get it there, a pressure not to answer the phone or have the nasty notes come to your house. It's an issue as it relates to being sandpapered in our culture. Education overload is the next one. In each decade, the educational level has risen. There is a trickle-down to education. In my day, when I went to kindergarten at 5 years of age 50 years ago, it was a great day if I found my right cup at juice time, and I eventually learned to tie my shoes. I successfully got through kindergarten. What are we learning today in kindergarten? Our kids learn to read in kindergarten. Part of it is the pressure of the society saying more, 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 more. Part of it is our kids are in a different world. I understand that. But the trickle-down of the demands. In a few years ago, a bachelor's degree in college was terrific. You were ready for all of society's demands. Today, that is not so. Kids going to college today automatically think grad school because they understand the demand for the education. There is an overload. Give yourself a score. How are you doing there? How about fatigue overload? We are absolutely a tired society. Not too long ago, the average woman got a little over 8 hours sleep. Today, the average American adult is under 6 hours, and many, many women are surviving on 4 hours a night. What does that do to you physically? It is sandpaper. It drains you. You cannot be a creative, whole, dynamic, loving, caring, patient adult when you're sleep deprived? Hurry overload. Oh my. You know, it's almost a disease. And what's happened is the commodity for our culture is no longer money, it's time. When someone asks you directions, how do you give directions? Is 4.2 miles east of here? No. You say it's about 4 minutes down the freeway. Everything is in increments of time. Where is the such and such church? Oh, it's about 6 minutes that way. It's about 12 minutes. Unless there's a lot of traffic, then it'll be about 20 minutes. Everything has to do with time. Everything is incremented in will it save us time? I was reading an article that talked about when the very first manufacturer came out with shampoo and conditioner in the same bottle. It was an instant bestseller. Not because it was particularly great shampoo or particularly great cream rinse. It's because it was in one. You only had to do one application, not two. Many products are chosen not because of the quality of the product, but because of the time element to deliver it. Often pizza companies rise and fall on their delivery time, not on the quality of the product. Why do you eat at McDonald's? Because it's great food? No. Because it's wonderfully priced? Not so. Why? Because they can get it to you in a hurry. You got hungry kids in the back of the car, boom, French fries, they're happy, we're done. It's an issue of time. We are a very hurried society. Give yourself a score there. Information overload. Today, a single edition of a New York Times Sunday morning newspaper will contain more information than a 17th century British gentleman would have known in his lifetime. Lifetime! One Sunday, a paper in your lap is going to give you more information than a guy would have gotten in an entire lifetime in the 17th century. You say, well, what's the big deal about that? Where do you put all that? And isn't there a demand inherent in our culture to get more of it? That is a pressure brought to bear on you and on our homes. Media overload. 95% of the homes in America have two or more TV sets, and they're on 7 or more hours a week. And as my pastor is famous for saying, even those who check the box we don't watch very often exceed 20 to 30 hours a week with the television set on. So the ones who admit that they watch it a lot, the set's on 7 hours plus each day. You say, well, what's the big deal about that? Two big deals. One, it's constant background noise, which sandpapers your soul as well. And two, it's garbage going in. And your kids and you both have to deal with it. It's unrealistic life expectancies. It sets for a consumer mentality. And the garbage that is on it now, both in the commercial side and then on the product side, is very hard to ferret through as a parent. Almost impossible. Noise overload. I can, on occasion, get to a place where I am on sensory overload. I have just had it with lights and sounds. I'll never forget my first trip to Korea. I got there. I was exhausted. The missionary took me to the finest room he had in his house, which was kind of a joke, but it was a corner room. The corner room was the corner of the building, and the corner of the building was the corner of the street. And what I did not realize is that the culture in the Orient is alive and well 24/7. There was noise, hawkers outside with those bullhorns all night long. All lights were left on. Neon was moving. People were talking. I remember sitting there taking my fingers and shoving them in my ear, putting the pillow over my head just to stop the senses from driving me crazy. I don't do that routinely at home, but that is an emotional response often to our world. Way too much noise. We have radios on, we have TVs on, we have stereos on, we have CDs playing, we have constant noise. It does affect us. We have people overload. You say, well, wait a minute, the Bible talks a lot about us being with people and people serving each other, and it does. But what happens when there's too much people contact? Well, a good example of this is the Orient. Go to Japan, go to China, go to any of the larger Asian countries and watch what happens to the culture when there's just too many people doing too many things in a small amount of space. it becomes very depersonalized. In the day and age of Little House on the Prairie, if you went to the mercantile to buy whatever it was you needed, there were three people in there maybe, and you carried on a conversation, you compared and contrast what you were going to buy and what it was for. It was a calm and gentle experience. You go to the grocery store today, what is it like? It is nonsense. It's nonstop people, and it depersonalizes us. We no longer think about them as a caring or needy or important person. They're just a body to get out of the way. Whether it's on our driving patterns, we're not courteous as drivers. We're not courteous in public places like grocery stores. We're awful. How many people stop and carry on a conversation with someone that's passing them in any of those environments? It just doesn't happen. Possession overload. Oh my goodness. We have more things per person than any other culture or race in history. Our closets are full. The biggest ad on TV right now is what to do with all the junk that's in your full garage so you can go rent this space over here. I have a 3-car garage, and on a good day we can get 1 car in. That's not good. Technology overload. The average now is that in your lifetime, you're going to learn 20,000 different pieces of technology. You're going to learn how to program and how to use them. Dennis claims that he's not going to learn anything else. If there's something that has to be programmed or learned, he's going to make his grandkids teach him. He refuses to learn it. I understand. We get a new piece of technology at the house. We hand it to Brianna. Can you make this work? You know, there's a point in which you just don't get it. Traffic overload, that's an understatement in our particular culture. And then plain and simple work overload. Whereas God ordained work for a purpose and had it balanced, you and I tend to not have it balanced. In fact, we sometimes brag about how long we work, as if you worked 80 hours a week, you were more valuable to your family or society than someone who only worked 30 hours a week. Not so. All right, tally up your score. How'd you do? Add them up. By the way, as you're doing that, let me tell you that this material came from a book called Margins, and it is a phenomenal book by Richard Swinson. If I had 7 books and only 7 books in my library, this would be one of my 7. I reread it every now and then. I'm doing another pass through right now. It's an excellent book. But he didn't present these as a quiz. And so in a kind of unscientific and just personal observation kind of way, I'm going to say that a score over 50 is going to put you and your family in some jeopardy. So how did you do? Anybody in the 20s? Got a couple. Very good. 30s? Okay, great. 40s? Okay, and we won't look any further because you're the ones that need to meet me afterwards outside, and we need to commiserate and change the way we're living. All right, what's my point? My point is that our homes are not pleasant, not gracious, not wonderful. They're harried. We are living in a society where stress is everywhere, where we spend, $9+ billion a year on stress-related products. With some humor, I was watching the news last night that was suggesting that our water supply is being affected by a whole host of drugs, among them the $9 billion worth of drugs that are for anxiety and stress-related disorders in our society. This is a huge issue. It's estimated that somewhere between 75 and 85% of all health care services and dollars are spent on some sort of stress-related issues. It is epidemic in our culture. So what needs to happen? What needs to happen is we have to find resting places. Like Ma and Pa did around the dinner table, you and I need to find places to rest, to find for our children rest. Their worlds are spinning just as fast as adults are, and it will impact them even more than ours affects us. A couple of things I want you to see in your Bible today. Turn to Exodus chapter 20. Let's start there, and then we're going to go to Psalm 37. All that was introduction. How did I do with my introduction? Not bad. All right. 30 minutes of introduction. I had to get your mind in the right place. The first step towards dealing with this little house on the freeway syndrome is to recognize this is not how God intended us to live. It's not His plan. It is not His plan that we live frazzled lives, edges of, as I put in your notes, lifeless commotion and piercing stress. That instead, God intended for there to be a healthy dose of appropriate rest. In fact, He commands it. It's not optional. It's not you ought to every now and then if you can get away. It is supposed to be a part of the rhythm of our lives. And in Exodus chapter 20, years ago, I made a very interesting observation that is just as interesting to me today as it was then. And that is, I ask you the question, which of the Ten Commandments occupied the most space in this dialogue about the Ten Commandments? Which commandment required more time, effort, words, indicators, commands than the rest of them in the Ten Commandments? And if you thought about it, you might say, well, I'm sure He had a lot to say about thou shalt not kill. That is a biggie. In my top ten, that would be right there. Thou shalt not murder. Or maybe, thou shalt not commit adultery. That would be a big one. Probably got a lot in there on that one. You want to know which one gets the most press? Which one gets the most space? Which one gets the most words? Which has the greatest emphasis in terms of three verses rather than just one verse or a phrase? It's the commandment to rest. Does that surprise you? It did me when I first thought about it. Look at Exodus 20. He starts off with the obviously most important statements having to do with Himself. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. I'm punishing the children for the sin of their fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, and I'm showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses His name. Skip verses 8 to 11 and go to verse 12. Honor your father and your mother so that you may live long in the land. That's one verse. You shall not murder. Very short verse. You shall not commit adultery. Another short verse. Verse 15. Four whole words. You shall not steal. 16. You shall not give false testimony. 17. You shall not covet your neighbor's house or his wife or his servants or his ox or donkeys or anything that belongs to him. Which one gets three verses? Verses 8 to 11. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, not your children, not your manservant, not your animals, not the alien within your gates. Why? Because in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, and the sea and all that's in them, but He rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Now, before you just say, wait a minute, Sherry, this is Sabbath, we're not under the law, we don't have to keep the Sabbath, this has nothing to do with us. Whoa, whoa, whoa. This is in the listing of the Ten Commandments. You're going to excuse away the rest of them? Of course you're not. Here is a command. It is phrased as a command. The command is on the topic of rest. And for 96 English words, at least in the translation that I counted, He pounds you and I to get the concept that rest is not only needed, it's appropriate. The pace of life should not be mind-boggling. There is nothing to be earned. No brownie points, no stars for having an endless run at life. Now, I said a little while ago, this lesson's for me. Man, am I on the south end of this one right now. I am in a spin. My own calendar right now is disgusting. I am very tired. It is bad the way I've allowed the marginlessness of my life. But this message is for me. It's also for you. Your calendar might not look like my particular calendar, but you may have issues with your kids. You may have allowed them to be involved in just too many things. How many nights a week do you sit around a table, husband, wife, and children, and have dinner? That is the number one indicator of how your children will turn out. Sociologists and psychologists will endorse that. The family that sits together and has dinner together, routinely exchanging life, checking in with each other, seeing what's going on, listening and talking, has a greater propensity to have a healthy life, both physically and emotionally, than any single other thing you can do as a parent. And sitting in the back of your car en route to another practice doesn't count. Okay. Boy, you got quiet. There's a pattern here. The pattern is work, be productive, then rest. Just exactly how Jesus did creation, the creation account in Genesis 1 and 2. Work, 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 rest. That's precisely the pattern he gave there. He gives a similar pattern when he talks to the Israelites about planting their crops. In fact, in Leviticus 25, I think it is, he gives them a great detailed instruction about how to grow their crops. And he says, you plant, da-da-da-da-da-da, 6 years in a row, you have your harvest, you replant, you harvest, replant, harvest. But on the seventh year, don't plant anything. Let the dirt rest. Why? Because he understood that the nutrients that were in the soil had to be replenished. In fact, good farmers will talk to you about a pattern. They plant this year, next year, same dirt, they plant something else, next year back to the other thing. The reason is the alternative, the plant that's being in that soil demands certain different things of the nutrients that are in the soil. If you plant the same thing all the time, it just sucks it dry. If you alternate it, the soil has a chance to replenish. Very true for planting, for agriculture, also very true for me. If I have pedal to the metal with an unceasing pattern to life, the only thing that can happen is something's got to break. It's not intended to be God's plan. His command is to rest. In fact, in Joshua chapter 1, turn there for a moment. Joshua, Judges, Ruth, you know. So Joshua chapter 1, and some instruction to the young leader, Joshua, in verse 13, here's a command again. He says, remember the command that Moses, the servant, the Lord God gave you. The Lord your God is giving you rest and has granted you this land. They had had a time period of wandering. They were going to have a time period of conquest. And in between, God was making sure that they understood there also needed to be a time for rest. The challenge is for us to not value everything else so highly. We value productivity very highly. We value the accumulation of things very highly. We value the accumulation of money very highly. And the higher we value those things, it drives us even more. If you diminish the value of those things, then there is an opportunity for you to embrace the commandment to rest. How do you do that? How do you do that in a practical way? I think Psalm 37 gives us some insight. So turn to Psalm 37. This is a psalm that would be valuable to have in your memory, especially the first few verses that I've stolen from, maybe the first seven. Obviously, this is David at a time when they're chasing him. He's going to, 40 verses, talk about what to do when you're under pressure. But there are at least five good thoughts that can be captured to help us with this whole topic of slowing down and learning to do some resting. In verse number one, the Bible says, do not fret because of evil men or be envious of those who do wrong. For like the grass, they will soon wither. Like the green plants, they will soon die away. The first three little words, do not fret, are underlined in my personal Bible. That is a good place to start in getting a mindset to embrace the concept of slowing down and resting. Do not fret. Do not fret. How much time do you spend worrying? How much time are anxious moments? 366 specific commandments in our Bible about not fearing. And the joke, of course, is he made sure we had one for every day, including leap year. We needed that 366th this year. 366 times we're commanded not to fear. If you're having a little trouble resting, it may be because your anxiousness is on a high note. Turn the rheostat down. Do not fret. Embrace the principles of not fearing. Look diligently at those principles and say to yourself, I need to apply that here and here and here in a relationship, in a family issue, as it relates to finances, as it relates to health. Do not fret. Second one is in verse 3. Trust. Trust in the Lord and do good, dwell in the land, and enjoy safe pasture. Trust. On the heels of do not fret is the logical, positive side of it. Learn to trust. Today was my dad's 81st birthday. And for years, I have missed his birthday because I kept thinking it was April 11th rather than March 11th. So it became a big joke that I would always call him on April 11th to wish him a happy birthday. Well, I finally got it down. I understood. I emailed him this week and said, hey, almost there. And first thing this morning, I called him on the phone to wish him a happy birthday. He said, where are you? I said, I'm in the car on my way to a board meeting. It's about 6:30 this morning. And he said, oh, I get it. You're en route somewhere. You're not even sitting in your home wishing me a happy birthday. He was chastising me. And I was teasing around with him and joking around. We were talking about some events and some things he was doing. And when I hung up the phone, he had made a comment that was a good kind of comment, made me a little nostalgic about wanting my dad around. And I realized that one of the elements to my relationship with my father is trust. I trust my dad. If my dad says he's going to do X, Y, Z, I'm guaranteeing, yeah, my dad's going to do it, particularly as it relates to me or my brothers. He's trustworthy. My father can be trusted. And in that, there's great peace in my relationship with him. I don't have to worry about whether he loves me or cares about me or would provide for me to the fullest extent of his resources. I trust him. Now, that's my earthly father. How much more my spiritual father? The Lord who has over and over and over again given me every reason to trust him. Why do I cling to certain things, certain issues, certain relationships, certain challenges, as if I was going to take care of it myself, when in fact I can trust in the Lord and do good, and then dwell in the land and enjoy what? Safe pasture. Psalm 23 is the great psalm we all hear at funerals and in a few places in our culture, but it is a magnificent picture of the relationship between God and us. We are dumb sheep, and he is the shepherd. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall what? Not want. Trust. If you're a dumb sheep, you're in trouble without the shepherd. Sheep are so stupid, if they get turned over on their back, they cannot right themselves. They can't physically get up. And what's worse is because of the way their body is made, very soon the liquid in their body starts to coagulate in places like their lungs, and they literally will suffocate. They will die on their back. The only hope they have is that a shepherd is paying attention, will come right them, stick them between his legs, and start rubbing them down so that blood circulates again in their body. And then they can breathe, and then they can live. They have to trust in that shepherd. That is exactly the picture for you and I. Trust. Fret not, trust. Look at the next verse, verse 4. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Fret not, trust. Cool word, delight. Take great joy in what? In the Lord. Not in stuff, not in the accumulation of stuff, not in the gathering of degrees or the gathering of acknowledgement of your achievements. And most of us, we're kind of ready to relegate our own achievements, but you don't want to relegate your kids. You want your kids to achieve all that. Suddenly you've shifted from your own achievement to the achievement of your children. That's just as wrong, because all that does is put them on the spin. Delight in the Lord. Take some time for reflection, for, whoo, boy, gosh, man, whoo, God is so good. Make lists of how good he is. I was having a season of prayer while I was up in the mountains this weekend, and I started immediately into my needs list. And could you bless, and could you bless, and could you bless, and could you fix, and could you take care of, and whatever. And I out loud stopped myself. I said, wait. I'm in a room by myself. I could get away with that. I said, hold it a minute here. Let's start with a little delighting. And then I refocused my mind and started praying out loud. Thank you for this, and thank you for that, and thank you for these. And man, it's great that we have. And then I got this, and oh, you do, and I am, and I get to, and I hear you. Then when I got around to my, could you, you know, get back on the track of my ATM requirements here, I had a much shorter list and a much better attitude. Delight. Fret not, trust, delight. Look at verse 5. Commit your way to the Lord. Kind of a left-handed way to say again, trust in him and he will do this. Commit. Committing is more than just a trusting in the sense of mental trust. This is it's all on the line. And one of the suggestions I make is that you write either a personal, or if you have a great relationship and your husband knows the Lord, a family mission statement. This is why we exist. This is why we are on planet Earth. This is why God has allowed us to have children. This is the goal of our lives. It's a personal or a family mission statement. That is a very healthy exercise to commit yourself to something other than the spin of normal life. You say, well, I don't have time to do that. That's our problem. That's our problem. Take an evening. If your children are such that you cannot leave them with someone else, take an evening. Get a babysitter. Go down to the beach. Sit at a picnic table. And the two of you spend 3 or 4 hours praying, thinking, and writing your commitment as a couple. If you can get away for a weekend, even better. Make certain that there's an opportunity to commit. And lastly, verse 7. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret when men succeed in their ways, when they carry out their wicked schemes. Then he goes on to talk about all kinds of other things. Be still or rest, some translations say. Stop the restless pace and actually allow yourself to enter into his resting place. I don't know of a message that is more appropriate in our culture than this one. And I really wasn't trying to make you feel guilty. I admit most readily that this is a difficult issue in my life. But when I get to a place where I am spinning out of control, I need to get back in Psalm 37. I need to say to myself, wait a minute, I refuse to fret. I will trust. I am going to delight in the Lord. I commit myself, and then I will respond in obedience to allowing some rest. Whether it's time rest or sleep rest, where it's mental rest, where it's turning off certain things or entering into certain things, you know those that are appropriate for your life. But if you do not, what happens is we fray all the edges of our life. We fray ourselves emotionally, we fray ourselves physically, and we certainly fray ourselves spiritually. Little House on the Freeway is nothing to brag about. We ought to be Little Houses on the Prairie. Let's pray together. Lord, tough lesson, not very many amens today, not a lot of fun, but a very appropriate lesson to hear from time to time. May we, starting with me, find a resting place in a restless world. Father, may I turn to you to organize and order my calendar. Can I give you the list of demands and things to do and ask you to bless and order them and prioritize them? Father, enter into the relationships that cause me time and anguish. And may I trust you with them. And Father, the relationships of husbands and wives, I pray for them today that they might come together and reorder their lives so that you could be in a strategic place, that their children would not have that frazzled sense to them, that there would be time for unstructured play and family activities and laughter and joy, the antithesis of many of our homes. Help us to take this message to heart, I pray today, in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, thanks for not or for coming. It would have been no fun without you to stand up here and preach it myself, which would have been no fun at all.